Through most of my school life, we would study the Bible, and there was a class time that was called religious instruction, RI, or Bible education. But by the time I went to high school and the pluralism and the kind of secularism was taking over, they changed the name and it became something more politically correct. It became life skills, which is a bit of a misnomer because it really didn't skill you for life. And but I think they probably would like to have called it Life 101, you know. But they felt that would have been a little bit ambitious. But in fact, when you read the book of Ecclesiastes, you are reading life skills. You are reading Life 101. This is the ultimate book on what life is about. And I remind you once again that the way to understand this book is to realize what he says at the end of the book in chapter 12, that there are goads and there are nails. At some point in the book, like a sharp-pointed goad, he's going to prick you with the intention of moving you out of the way you're thinking and living now. And other times, he's going to take nails, tent pegs, hammer them into the ground and say, you can live under this. You can set your life up under this. So, let's begin this book. Picture yourself now walking into your first lecture with Solomon on what life is about. We're going to see his brutal conclusion. Solomon is no ear-tickling prophet who's going to tell you what you want to hear. Solomon doesn't even wait to kind of build up to what he wants to say. He swills his cup, takes a drink, swallows, sets it down, and then says to you, want to know the meaning of life? Here it is. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Verse 2, the second verse of the whole book. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He begins his book with a conclusion. In fact, you're going to see two conclusions, the conclusion at the beginning and the conclusion at the end. The conclusion at the beginning is the conclusion of life lived under the sun. You're going to hear that term again and again and again. Life lived under the sun, what does that mean? It's life lived by a person who doesn't believe that there's anything above the sun. That all there is to life is what the sun hits and shines on. Just physical, material life, nothing beyond, nothing above us, no one else. No spirit, no God, no final judgment. What we call a secularist. That's life under the sun. It's the life of the atheist. Whether you're a theoretical atheist who says there is no God and you make that big statement, or whether you're a practical atheist who says, yeah, there might be a God, but what difference does that make to my life? And by the way, there's many Christians who live as practical atheists. Yeah, I believe in God, but what difference does that make to me? Why should God impact my life? I don't care about life with God. What Solomon's going to do is if you live life under the sun, he's going to force you to conclude the logical end of living life that way. He's not going to let you off the hook. He's going to keep pushing you and poking you and goading you until you've got to stare in the face the ultimate conclusion of living life that way. And he's not going to let you go. So what he says, beginning in verse number 2, is he says, life lived under the sun, life lived that way is vanity. Vanity of vanities. Now if you've been reading this book, as I asked you to just read through it and try to get through it at least 5 times, you would have seen him say vanity of vanities. And he says this about just about everything. Human wisdom, human achievement, human religion, youth, success, wealth, pleasure, property, work, rivalry. He just calls it vanity. Vanity, vanity, vanity. What does that mean? Well, the word in the Hebrew means emptiness. Weightlessness, pointlessness. You could think of it this way. It's the nearest thing to zero. Solomon says, add up all of life. Take everything that man does, all of his achievements, all of his goals, all of the ways he tries to make life work, all of the stuff that he does, all the goals he pursues. Take all of life, all through history, put it on a scale, and the needle won't even wobble. Weightless, pointless, useless. The Hebrew word also has a second shade of meaning, and it means this: frustrating. mysterious, incomprehensible. He says, all of life, all of those things are completely puzzling. They're contradictions. They don't add up. So here's the brutal conclusion, twofold. Life is puzzling and life is pointless. Life won't satisfy you and life will never give you the answers of why you're here in the first place. No satisfaction, no solutions, and yet satisfaction and solutions are what you're looking for your whole life. Now in verses 3 to 11, he's going to give you the big picture of why life lived under the sun is pointless and puzzling. Look at verse 3 down to verse 8. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. He says, what profit? What gain does man actually get out of life? And before you say, well, that's a little bit of a mercenary question, remember that Jesus asked the same thing, didn't he? What will it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? You see, we seek profit, we seek purpose, we seek meaning, we want to be satisfied, we want answers. But Solomon says, you know what? It's pointless. You know why? Because no matter what you do, you die. Solomon tells us that creation actually, almost like mocking us, creation in the background provides this backdrop which just seems to remind us that we are temporary and things just keep on going. The sun rises, the sun sets. The wind goes, the wind comes. The rain comes, rivers get full, they flow into the sea, evaporation happens, rain comes again. Creation just mindlessly keeps on churning it out, pumping on, not progressing, just continuing. The sea doesn't fill up, the earth doesn't reach a destination, it's just one big cycle. Monotonous repetition that never ends, and we're stuck here, reminded that we're going to die. We're not going to be like the rain or the sun. Ever occurred to you as you look up to those stars that Abraham looked at the same ones and they're still there? Ever occurred to you that that same landscape which you stare at, people saw those same features, those same mountains thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago, they're gone. Ever occurred to you that there will be people hundreds of years from now, if the Lord tarries, that will see the things you're seeing and you'll be gone? And so Solomon's telling us, all these cycles are goading us. You won't be here in 100 years. And if you won't, then what's the point? You see, if what's the point of doing anything if the end of all of it is death? You see, if the destination is the same for everyone, it makes a mockery of the journey. If rich and poor, oppressed and powerful, smart and simple, all end up in the same dust heap, why try to be one over the other? What's the point? And the answer is, there is no point. There's absolutely no point if you live life under the sun. The earth just keeps being here and being here while you die. And guess what? You don't make a very big splash. You can build your little sand castles on the beach and the tide of time is going to come and wash it all away. Sound depressing? You see, Solomon's not going to add in a little bit of sherbet cheer. You know? Oh, but it's not so bad. No, it is so bad. If you're going to live life under the sun, that's where you've got to end up. All things, he says in verse 8, are full of labor. It's weary. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. You know, our world is a chronic boredom problem. And it's not new. People are bored. The world is tiresome. It doesn't satisfy. Someone said it this way, and this is really true. They said, sin at first is novelty, then drudgery, then slavery. It loses its satisfaction, and pretty soon that extreme party you had is just part of the tedium. One of the strangest things is to be in the middle of a party and to see people, you know, with these kind of pasted grins on their faces, but you can see they're bored. It's a strange experience to be in the middle of this kind of celebration of nothingness, celebration of celebration, and you see there's actually a tiredness and a tediousness in the faces of the people that say, is this really it? Is this all there is? And so with a tired world where people are just growing and doing the same thing and dying and it's so pointless, a bored and tired world that lives under the sun has one hope, and it's the future. Because the future will bring the answers. You see, we'll get some new technologies, we'll get new ideas, new discoveries, new advancements, and it will bring progress. You've seen the concept drawings of the artists as they show you what the future will be like. That'll satisfy, that'll bring meaning, it'll solve the apparent emptiness of life. This will make it all make sense. You know what Solomon says? No, it won't. Look at verse 9. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. Solomon says, don't expect anything new. The same cycles are going to continue. What has been done is what will be. What has been done in the past is going to be done in the future, just with a twist. Oh, sure, we'll have some new gadgets. We'll have some new technologies. We'll have a few novelties. But really, they're not true novelties because they never change the fundamental questions. You know how we know that nothing's really changed? Is that this book is 3,000 years old and man still hasn't answered its questions. They're still relevant to us. No one's written a book where someone said, well, finally we know what it's all about. You know, here we are, we've been doing all this stuff and finally this guy's written a book and it's on our shelves and this is what we're supposed to do. No. The questions haven't been answered, so there's nothing new under the sun. The fact that this book resonates with us proves the point. There's nothing new. It's the same cycle living, same cycle of life, same emptiness. And to the atheist living under the sun, Solomon whispers, welcome to the rest of your life. He's merciless. It's not going to get any better than this, Solomon says. And just as the godless person is swallowing hard at this bitter news, here Solomon gives the knockout blow. Look at verse 11. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. The past will be forgotten. Eventually the future that you're hoping in will be in the past and will also be forgotten. All you have is your little present moment, which is pointless, wearying, unsatisfying. So what's the point? Boy, you can just hear the gun cocking, you know, as a person starts to contemplate, well, what is the point? That's his goading conclusion. It's an endless cycle, and you don't make much difference at all, and guess what? You can't change it. Look at verse 14. I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. You can't fix what you don't like, and you can't count up what isn't there. You can't figure it out. You can't change the pointlessness of it, and you can't tally it up and come with an answer either. Life is pointless. Life is puzzling. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, at some point, Solomon decided to pick himself up from the floor of self-pity and depression, and he wanted to test life out for satisfaction and for solutions. We've already seen 2 weeks ago how he was uniquely placed to do that. We've already studied his authority to answer these questions. So Solomon was going to be the scientist in the white lab coat doing tests. Only the twist was that he was going to be in the test tube as well. Because he was going to do the test on himself while maintaining an observer status and doing observations. So he decided to test life on himself and watch the reactions. Look in verse 12 and 13. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that he's done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. By the way, that's the only time God is mentioned in the chapter, and you'll notice the view of God makes him hard. God gives man this grievous, miserable, unhappy existence. So this is his, he's gearing up to find some answers. Verse 16, I communed with my heart saying, look, I've attained greatness. I've gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. So here he is. He's about to go. He's decided to find the answers. He's gathering all his resources, and this is the big experiment. Capital B, capital E. The big experiment. So first, he searched for satisfaction in pleasure. Look in chapter 2 and verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this also is vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? The two words translated laughter and mirth are two different words in the Hebrew. One means a frivolous, crazy, hilarious kind of joy, you know, the party joy. And the other is the more considered, cultured, careful joy. And his conclusion? Party happiness? Madness. Civilized happiness, what good does it do? So here we find out how he tested it. Verse 3 we find out, and just scan over these verses as I comment on them. In verse 3 we find out he indulged his body with wine while still being guided by wisdom. He didn't lose himself in the experiment, which would have rendered it all useless. He was still experimenting and watching. In verse 4 we find out he tried to find pleasure in building. Architecture, interior decoration. It became his hobby, building and design. In verse 5 and 6, we find that he sought pleasure in horticulture, farming, landscaping, beauty in nature. Dave, maybe he was a game ranger. He tamed nature for pleasure. He built massive reservoirs to hold the water to supply his gardens. In verse 7 and 8, we find out that he looked for pleasure in materialism. He bought all kinds of goods and services. He bought servants, employees, herds, flocks, farms, silver, gold, special collector's items. You know, in the ancient world, a king would always have this room with particular items that had been brought in, strange things from India and from Africa. He had that. He collected stuff. And the middle of verse 8 tells us he looked for pleasure in music, the arts and culture. He provided for himself what we would call entertainment. In the end of verse 8, interestingly, in the New King James and King James, it's translated musical instruments. It can actually and probably should be translated concubines, which would confirm that what we read in 1 Kings, Solomon sought pleasure in sexuality. In verse 9, we find out that he was offered pleasure in his fame and his power, but it didn't go to his head. His wisdom stayed with him. So, here comes the big description of the big experiment. Verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. Wow. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Wow. So, the findings is... Scientist Solomon comes up, you know, here's the journal, here's the scientific speech. He's about to announce the findings of the big experiment. Here it is. You want to know what pleasure will do? He's put it under the Bunsen burner. He swirled it around. He's observed. Here's the big conclusion, verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. This is what we call the morning after the night before. And the emotional hangover was not pretty. He felt spent. He felt guilty. He felt empty. See, when the party's over, the reality sinks in. What did this really do? What did this really do? Story is told of a disturbed patient who was going to a psychiatrist for severe depression. And nothing that the psychiatrist had done had helped. And he woke up discouraged and blue every day, and the condition got worse and progressed. And he got more and more desperate, and the psychiatrist got more and more desperate, because nothing that the psychiatrist was recommending, which by the way is always under the sun, nothing that he was recommending was helping. So one day, just in desperation, the psychiatrist turned to him and said, "Listen, you know, there's an Italian clown down the road who has the audience convulsing in laughter, and I suggest you just go get a night out, at least attend the show. It's going to be excellent therapy to just laugh for a couple of hours. Go and see Grimaldi, the Italian clown." And with a defeated expression, the patient looked into the doctor's eyes and said, "Doctor, I am Grimaldi. I am the clown." See, when all the laughter's over, no satisfaction. It's as pointless as trying to grab the wind in your hands. Solomon said he gained nothing. It was pointless. It was puzzling. The laughter was insanity. The happiness didn't benefit. It's an interesting fact that Beverly Hills, California, the home of the Hollywood stars, has more psychiatrists per square mile than any other community in the world. Pleasure doesn't satisfy. The search for satisfaction in pleasure came up naught. So now he turned to philosophy, the search for solutions in philosophy. Look at verse 12. "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done." So now he does a 180. He has been in the boiling hot waters of passion and appetite, so now he's going to turn to the cold and chilly and considered waters of logic and analysis and philosophy, rational thinking. That's what he's going to look to now. Maybe he has the answers. Now, you know that the kind of wisdom that Solomon was looking to now was the wisdom under the sun. How do we know that? Because he always tells us that the true beginning of wisdom is what? The fear of the Lord. He doesn't mention that here. In other words, God's not in the picture. What he is turning to is the best reasoning and reflection that a godless man can do. That's what he's doing. The best meditation and philosophy that man can come up with is what he's turning to now. He's looking for answers. And he knows that reflection is better than none. Look at verses 13 and 14. "Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness." In other words, at least the man who thinks about life and tries to figure it out is seeing some things. He's not a party animal that's just pretending and trying to escape and trying to medicate the depression. He's at least facing it. But pretty soon, the problems start to stack up. Problem number one: worldly wisdom makes you more aware of life's problems without any answers. Look at verse 18. He says, chapter 1, verse 18, "For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow." The man who takes the time to reflect on life, to consider its puzzles and its contradictions, and he has no revelation from God, he's just thinking under the sun, will come to painful conclusions. In fact, he or she will come to depression. Because reflection without revelation is painful, and it's meant to be. Some of you may have heard of Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher of the 20th century. He was a man who just was a quintessential under-the-sun philosopher. He wrote this: "Man is a useless passion. Everything that exists is born for no reason. It carries on living through weakness, and it dies by accident." Nice guy. And guess what he said when he died? His last words: "I failed." Worldly wisdom helps you to see the problems, but there's no solutions. And that's just like pouring salt on the wound. Second problem is that wise people die just like fools. Look at chapter 2 and verse 14. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceived that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity, for there's no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come, and how does a wise man die as the fool? So you go to all the trouble of tormenting yourself with the big questions. You try to look at life carefully. You try to see the problems, and you see them more clearly. You know what the problems are. You don't solve them, but you have more understanding than the fool does. And then Solomon says, and then you die, just like the fool. So what's the point? You see, if I'm on an airplane that's about to crash, what difference does it make if I'm reading Plato and Aristotle and the guy next to me is reading a U magazine? What difference does it make? Oh, well, I'm reading philosophy and he's just reading you. I mean, he's reading the National Enquirer. What a simple fellow. Well, we're both going to die. What's the point? The answer? There is no point. If you're living life under the sun and the destination is the same for all of us, then the journey is nonsense. And the third problem is wise people have to leave all their work to fools. Look at verse 18 of chapter 2. Then I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule all over my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Verse 21, for there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who's not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. If you spend all day trying to push your car up a gentle slope, and after huffing and puffing and just about tearing your Achilles tendons, you get that car 100 meters up and pull the handbrake and go to bed and get some rest, and the next morning some joker gets in, releases the handbrake, rolls it right back down, what's the point? So you spend all your life making wise decisions, studying philosophy, studying logic, studying reason, seeing things as they really should be, and then you pass the baton on to someone who doesn't care about that at all. Solomon ruled by wisdom, he ruled by logic, and he says, and I might give it all over to someone who's going to undo the whole thing with foolishness. What's the point? You could take that even ministerially. You know, if I'm just living as a pastor under the sun, you know, I could be in this church and, you know, and maybe God would have it be that I'd be like, you know, MacArthur or someone, have not like that, but 40 years in one place. And for 40 years just minister and build and work and go, and we have this whole thing built up. And then finally I die, and then someone comes in and takes it over, and in 2 years just turns the whole thing around. Can that happen? Sure. So what's the point? If all you have is here, there is no point. What's the point of philosophy, knowledge, and rationalism? You can see the problems clearer, but you don't have solutions. You end up dying just like the fool who never thought about them. And when you do die, a fool takes over from you as if you were never there. Ouch. Two very painful goads. Pleasure doesn't satisfy, and human philosophy doesn't solve anything. So what do you do if you're living life under the sun and you find out that pleasure doesn't satisfy and human reason doesn't solve anything? You know what you do? You despair. Verse 17 of chapter 2. Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Verse 20. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. Look at verse 22. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. Do you know what despair is? You know what depression is? It's sorrow without hope. God has made you and He's made me to experience pain. Pain is actually a blessing. If you didn't experience pain while you put your hand on that hot stove, you'd burn it right through. Pain is a protection. When you feel pain, you're supposed to do something with it. Pain is a protection in a cursed world. But God puts emotional pain into our lives as well. It's the pain of sensing that this is under a curse. That life seems to offer so many things to have joy with, but they don't bring the joy. That the world has so much evidence of intelligent design, but it keeps returning nonsensical answers. And that stings. That hurts. You didn't ask to be born, but here you are. You didn't ask to desire pleasure, but it's how you're made. You want it, you can't get it. You didn't ask to want to understand things, but you just do. You have that desire, and there are no answers under the sun, and it stings, it goads, it's painful. And a person who sits and reflects on that long enough will despair. If they do it under the sun, and they're meant to. See, they're not meant to run from the brutal conclusion that pleasure doesn't satisfy and human wisdom doesn't solve anything. They're not meant to escape it and just go on holidays and have fun and be with friends and say, well, you know, we might as well make the journey comfortable. If the plane's going to crash, at least let's sit in first class. No, it's not meant to do that. We're not meant to medicate it. We're not meant to try to forget it. And guess what? A loving God also doesn't expect you to just sit on those goads and lose hope. He doesn't want that for you either. A goad is meant to move you. So where is He moving you? He wants to move you to His first nail, His first tent peg. Here comes the first inbreaking of divine revelation. Here comes the first glimpse of a view from above the sun. Look at verse 24. But I hope you're thirsty for this by now. Verse 24. Nothing is better for a man that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him as good before God. But this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Here's the truth. Life is meant to be enjoyed. It's meant to be enjoyed. Nothing is better for a man that his soul should enjoy good. God made the world to be enjoyed. The book of Genesis, what does God keep saying about His creation? It was good. Genesis 2 verse 9, He describes the trees in the garden of Eden, and it's pleasant. They're good for the eyes, good for fruit. Life's meant to be enjoyed. Even in our fallen state, 1 Timothy 4:4 says, for every creature of God is good and nothing to be refused if it's received with thanksgiving. Life's meant to be enjoyed. So you say, well, how does that add up? Here's the hinge. Don't miss this. This is the main point. The enjoyment of life is a gift from God. Notice in your text, at the end of verse 24, this also I saw that it was from the hand of God. Verse 26, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. And in fact, verse 25 should be translated this way, for who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from Him? If you have the ESV, the New American Standard, or the NIV, you'll see that, or the Holman Christian. Who can enjoy life apart from Him? Here's what the Bible's saying. You can get all the gifts you like. You can get all the philosophy you like. But if you don't have the giver, the gifts won't make sense and they won't satisfy. We think that the things will bring joy automatically. See, we have the idea that the things bring joy the way a fruit has a taste connected to it. And the Bible says, no, no, joy is a separate gift to the gift. See, think about that. Why do you think God would do that? Why would God make joy a separate gift from the gifts? Why would God give us gifts that hold out the promise of satisfaction all around us? I mean, marriage, children, life, nature, you know, money that He gives us that can give us buying power. These are gifts. Why does He give us gifts that hold out the promise of satisfaction, but actually do nothing but torment you unless you get the gift of joy from him. Why would he do that? Because God will not have his gifts become the idols of our hearts. He will not share his glory with his gifts. He will not allow his gifts to function if they are divorced from him. God gives the gift, but he will not grant you the satisfaction unless you come to him in a dependent relationship. See, like Jim Berg said, I've mentioned this before, you can gather all the toys you like, but God holds on to the batteries. And you can sit and click on them, and like my son says, all gone. Because the light's not going on. Why? The battery's not working. There's no battery in it. Unless you please him, none of the gifts will work. Unless you're in a relationship with him and seeking him as your end, not as a means, all the gifts will malfunction and all the wisdom and knowledge you can gather won't make sense. The same thing is said later on in chapter 5. Look at verse 19, another tent peg of revelation. Chapter 5, verse 18, here is what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. Do you notice that God not only has to give you the riches and wealth, he's got to give you the power to eat of it. He's got to give you the gift of joy with the gift. Friends, God is not mocked. You cannot live in his world, tread down his green earth, breathe his air, live by his permission, pursue his gifts, and then ignore him and think that they'll work. Do that, and life is vanity. Martin Lloyd-Jones said, "Worldliness is anything that tries to satisfy us apart from God." Worldliness. Isn't that amazing? Let me borrow from Jim Berg again because it's such a helpful illustration. He talked about the equation of enjoyment. Whatever things you obtain, imagine that you put it on this side, the multiplicand. Okay? Whatever things you get that house, you get that job, you get that husband or wife, you get children, you get health. So here it is, the multiplicand. And you stack it up. Maybe you got 1, 2, 3, maybe you got 8. Now you multiply it by the multiplier, which is God. God giving you power to enjoy it. So let me ask you a question. If you've stacked up this side with all kinds of stuff, and you multiply it by 0, how much enjoyment do you get? So, but no, I'll stack it up with a lot of stuff. I mean, really. I mean, I'll have the best holidays, and I'll be everywhere, and I'll get a big salary. I mean, mine won't be 8. Mine will be 25. Mine will be 7,492 times by 0 is. Let's reverse it. Let's say you've only got 1. Let's say you're a Christian like we saw in the slideshows last week. You live in a mud hut. You have 1 page of scripture. You eke out a living every day. You got 1. Times by, God gives you 100. How much joy do you have? You see, God has got to give you power to enjoy it. And if God multiplies the enjoyment because you're in a dependent relationship with him, it really doesn't matter how much stuff you've got here. With food and clothing, let us therewith be content. But too many Christians are busy asking God to help them get more stuff here. God, help me to get more stuff. Help me to get a better salary, better marks. Help me to get the degree. Help me to get the promotion. Help me to get more friends. God, please bless me on this side, then I'll be happy. God says, no. That won't. If I keep multiplying it by 0, it will still be 0. You need to make me the satisfaction of your heart, and then I am quite happy to load this side with as many as I see fit. Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who richly gives us all things to enjoy. Here at the end of chapter 2, he tells us that the sinner, God gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give it to the one who pleases God. And he says that's also vanity and grasping. He's not saying eating and drinking is vanity. He's saying living a life where God confiscates all your stuff and gives it to a believer, he says that's vanity. The sinner has a lot of his lot is to just lay up stuff for the righteous, and he loses it in the end. Solomon's goads prick us. Life is pointless, pleasure doesn't satisfy, life's a puzzle, and philosophy doesn't solve it. And in the end, you die, and you haven't changed anything, and the people after you come and revise all that you've done, and your little sandcastle is completely washed away, and no one knows it was ever there. And this is the way it's been, and this is the way it will be. But if you acknowledge God, then you will see that life is not a cruel joke. Life's actually designed to delight the humble. It's designed to yield sweet fruits to those who come to God on His terms. Because then all of God's gifts are safe in your hands. You come to God, you make right with Him through His Son Jesus Christ. You seek forgiveness for sins and a right standing with Him. You seek to live and honor and please Him. You acknowledge Him not as a means to help you get your stuff, but as the ultimate end of your life. And when you do this, let me tell you, God is delighted not only to give you the gifts, but to grant the satisfaction, knowing that you're satisfied in Him. God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him, said John Piper, and that's true. In Him, not merely through Him, in Him. When we are satisfied in God, God is happy to pour on the joys of life, because each one causes more joy in Him. This tent peg should humble you and give you hope. Like, life isn't a cruel joke, except if you insist upon living under the sun. But if you'll come to the Creator of it and humble yourself and acknowledge Him and make Him and see Him as the end, He will add that multiplier and turn whatever gifts He's given to you as great causes for joy and satisfaction in Him. And we can praise Him for that. What a wise God, isn't He? We can't outfox Him. We can't beat Him at His own game. We must submit to Him. Let's pray.